Welcome to Instigators of Change, a Coastal Ventures podcast where we take a look at innovative ideas, the people who come up with them, and those who invest in them. I'm Kara Miller, and today, perhaps one of the most innovative women in the country.
I think I've said for the last 10 years, there's never been a more important time to be a scientist or engineer. There's so many problems that need to be solved, and there's so many solutions where at least part of the answer is from science, engineering, or invention.
Angela Belcher, a material scientist, a biological engineer, and a cancer researcher, talks about how she's racing to help patients, fix the environment, and break departmental barriers if she needs to. That's just ahead on Instigators of Change. This is not a normal interview because Angela Belcher is not your typical interviewee. This is going to be more like a walk through Belcher's brain, which, to be fair, is pretty impressive. She's the head of the Department of Biological Engineering at MIT, and she works with an array of equally impressive colleagues at the Koch Institute for Integrative Cancer Research, also at MIT. Rolling Stone has named her one of the 100 people changing the country, and she won the $500,000 Lemelson MIT Prize for invention. But even she's been surprised, as you're going to hear, at how her research has expanded starting about a decade ago.
The president of MIT at the time, Susan Hockfield, came to me and said, you know, have you thought about working on cancer? I'm putting together this new institute where it's going to be cancer biologists and engineers working together, in the same building, in the same floors. And I said, well, you know, I work on batteries and I work on solar cells.
That, though, was about to change, because the more Belcher thought about it, the more she realized she wanted to be involved in unraveling the mysteries of cancer.
My mom had uterine cancer when I was born. And I was born, and then she went under for a full hysterectomy at 25, and then had reoccurring breast cancer after that, and then died early from breast cancer. And so at the same time, I'm thinking, wow, this is... I really want the best people working on that.
Belcher would eventually say yes to cancer research, but we will get back to that story later. If you start at the beginning and you're wondering how a top scientist, who's also gotten dozens of patents, started doing what she's doing, you'll find the answer on the beach. If you look around very carefully for an abalone shell.
I'm actually holding an abalone shell in my hand right here. They're really a beautiful and exquisite biomaterial. You've probably seen them before. They have this beautiful shell structure. They can be different colors. The red abalone has a red outer shell. And if you flip it over on the inside, it has this mother of pearl iridescent-like structure.
Belcher says that abalone shells are particularly awesome because they're hiding a couple of secrets.
So organisms in the ocean started making hard materials when there was increased, say, calcium and silicon and iron in the ocean, and it was toxic to the sea organisms. And so they repurposed the proteins that they already had, and they used them to actually capture some of these ions or some of these metals in solution.
Basically, these organisms are doing cleanup. And what's better than turning something that's annoying you into something that's actually useful, which in this case is a nice, protective, nanostructured layer.
So they took a situation that wasn't good, and they built these beautiful materials, these strong materials, and these hard materials that could protect their soft bodies. And, you know, it's quite remarkable. And I've spent my career based on that principle that, wow, you know, biology wasn't always meant to grow inorganic materials, or wasn't always meant to grow hard materials or nanostructured materials, but was given the opportunity, they could expand their toolkit and make really extraordinary structures and extraordinary materials.
I know that a lot of people are going to know about CRISPR and about the idea of changing around different sequences in the human body. And I know you've worked with changing around DNA sequences so that they can kind of build something maybe unexpected. Tell me about the evolution of that work and like where things stand now.
So there's definitely similarities in that we take relatively simple structures or simple organisms like yeast or bacteriophages, viruses that infect bacteria, and we change their DNA and add DNA and subtract DNA to get them to be able to construct a material that we're interested in. And a lot of the earlier material we worked on were more in the electronics industry, and we were making materials for touchscreen displays, for example, and we've made materials for catalyst. We've made materials for battery electrodes, both positive and negative electrodes. In the recent years, although we still work in all those areas, we've been thinking more about environmental remediation. Some recent work that we've done really goes back to thinking about abalone shells. But in this case, we're using yeast, the same kind of yeast you use to make beer or bread. Okay. And we've been engineering them to specifically transport in toxic materials like mercury or cadmium or lead and separate it out as a water purification system. And so we've been doing both protein engineering and metabolic engineering to get these, you know, simple organism yeast to clean up the oil sands, for example. And they're doing it by actually either trapping those metals or mineralizing those metals. Another thing that we've been working on recently that really took kind of a zigzag path to get where we are today in it was engineering viruses or bacteriophage to make really high surface area carbons. And it was, again, it came from a different direction. It came from us trying to build these biological carbon electrodes as part of a battery. And this was for a lithium sulfur battery. And we used these beautiful structures that are M13 bacteriophages, which are viruses that infect bacteria. I say they're beautiful because they are. They're kind of long and skinny viruses, and they're made out of just single-stranded DNA and proteins, and they assemble themselves inside of a bacteria. It's really quite extraordinary. And they're always the same length when they're made. But we use them as a template to make carbon-based resins, a really high surface area carbon-based resins on the order of 2,000 meters squared per gram. And that's like 1.5 hockey rinks of surface area per gram of material. So really high surface area. And we were using it in battery electrodes, and it worked okay, but it didn't have the intention that we originally wanted it to. But we found that it was really good at absorbing polysulfides, which were poisoning batteries. So that was really interesting. And so we just took that material and said, wow, if it can do really good at absorbing these small sulfur molecules, what else can it absorb? And so we went out and we found, wow, it's great at absorbing materials that would be toxins in water or dyes. And we looked at it for materials for drug overdoses. And we also looked at it for the ability to bind something very, very quickly. It was 30 times faster than other materials for binding. I said to myself, well, what would you want to bind faster than any other molecule if you needed to bind something really quickly? And no one else really came up with the same answer, which was me, but I said I'd want to use it for a chemical warfare agent. You know, I'd want to be able to neutralize a chemical warfare agent really quickly.
And so the idea being there's something in the air, but this thing you're putting out absorbs that like bad thing in the air.
It does. And it actually works quite well. So we started working with collaborators in the Army to see that, sure enough, it did. It was very effective. And not only that, it neutralized the material. It broke it down into non-toxic components. And then we started testing other toxic industrial chemicals, and it did the same. And we're thinking, oh, that's pretty interesting. And so we actually scaled it and have made textiles out of it. I'm holding one of the textiles right here. You can make masks out of it. And then during the beginning of the pandemic, we said, well, I wonder if you can use these on masks. I wonder if you could make, you know, mask N95 mask or surgical masks better. And so we developed a method with our collaborators in the Army to be able to spray it on masks, and showed that it actually can be used to increase the ability to remove toxic chemicals, but also it can neutralize viruses. And we showed that it can neutralize, you know, some viruses and viruses very similar to SARS-CoV-2. And so it's just interesting how we, you know, we started with the shell, we make all kinds of different materials and just follow where it takes us. And now we're looking at PFAS. Now we're looking at its ability to absorb these forever chemicals. It does so very well, like from solution.
You talked a little bit about this idea of having these sort of little pieces of nature work for you, whether it's like bacteria or viruses or yeast, and like having them do some of this work. Again, I wonder, where do you think that's headed? Do you feel like in the next few years, we're going to have a lot more deploying, I mean, a lot of people think of bacteria and viruses as terrible things that they wouldn't want near them. But do you feel like the trajectory of that research is like, yes, these little things are going to have a lot more impact in different parts of our lives?
I think so, for sure. And it's not just my work. The field is really exploding with a lot of young talent where they're interested in synthetic biology to produce things that biology wasn't normally intended to create. And it could be drug molecules, it could be building supplies, it could be some of the things that you mentioned for environmental remediation or CO2 to products. I think biomanufacturing is going to be a huge part of our economy and our lives in the years to come.
When you think about, you know, let's say in 10 years, how my life or your life might be different because of biomanufacturing, because there's stuff being done at this kind of scale where maybe the end consumer doesn't realize it's being done. But how do you feel like a normal person's life might be changed? Like, what is it that they interact with in a day that's different because of this work?
Well, I think one of the really important things to think about, and I've thought about this since I first was fascinated with the abalone in the ocean. The abalone makes its materials in the environment which it lives in, and it doesn't add toxic materials back into the environment because, you know, that would be no advantage to the organism itself. And I think it's the same thing when you look at biomanufacturing. If you look at using bacteria or yeast to synthesize a molecule or synthesize a polymer, I think one of the main advantages is kind of on-demand materials, how you can reprogram an organism to make a slight modification in a small molecule or a drug or a polymer to be easier to adapt to a particular application. And it could be a therapeutic. But I think to me, one of the major advantages is going to be doing it in a way that has a lower impact on the environment, doing it lower temperature, doing it without solvents that may have an impact on the environment. And I think we're going to be able to make a lot of things biologically and using synthetic biology and biological roots that are currently made in non-biological ways.
Let's talk a little bit about the cancer work that you've been doing recently, which I know is a departure for you. If you go back in history, 1971, Richard Nixon says, we're going to have a big effort. We're going to defeat cancer. A lot of people know, certainly during the Obama administration, Joe Biden, who was then the vice president, said, OK, this is going to be a cancer moonshot. We're going to do it. Before we get into the stuff that you're doing, what is your sense of why this effort has gone on for at least more than 50 years?
Well, I think that, and I'm more of an engineer than a cancer biologist, but I think that there's a perception that cancer is one disease, and it's not. It's many different diseases, and in different people, it presents different and is treated differently. So I think, you know, grouping it all together as cancer is not, you know, the best way to look at it. And, you know, I'm pretty excited about the moonshot. I'm pretty excited about the new effort and approaches that are being applied. And for my personal, as I'm sitting here in the Koch Institute, it's half cancer biologists, and half engineers working together. The thing that excites me about it is looking at these different particular diseases from multiple directions. And so in my suite, I'm the only engineer, the rest are cancer biologists. And, you know, we all have the same goal, which is to make an impact on cancer. And I work on many different kinds of cancers. I'm particularly passionate about ovarian cancer. But we bring different ideas, different approaches, and different solutions together. And it's when we're sitting down, you know, at the table or sitting in the conference room or being side by side in the lab with these different approaches, I really feel like that's a way to make that we can really make an impact. And I have two collaborators that are both engineers. Paula Hammond's a chemical engineer, and Sangeeta Bhatia is electrical engineer and a couple other kinds of things as well. And the three of us are focused on solutions for treatment and early diagnosis and interception of ovarian cancer. And I have to say that I'm excited about so many things right now. I'm excited about energy. I'm excited about environmental remediation. But I'm really excited about early diagnostics and interception of ovarian cancer.
Do you feel like that intersection of like biologists meeting engineers is how, you know, dealing with cancer is going to move forward, where these like people who normally inhabit different silos start crossing silos?
I think it's definitely important. And one of the most important pieces of that is also the clinicians, which we work closely with here in our institute as well, because that is an enormous part of the puzzle, these groups working together. And I'm not going to say that that is the answer, but I'm hoping that tremendous progress, at least in ovarian cancer where we're focused, will take place. Because over the summer, I think the pandemic was, you know, to say it was hard is an understatement, but many of us went through, you know, different, you know, I wouldn't say ups, but different, you know, feelings during this time, and at certain times were better than others. Right. But I have to say, one of the things that really helped me through was these meetings I had with this new foundation called Breakthrough Cancer. And the idea was to get scientists and engineers and clinicians, surgeons, you know, together from five different institutions around the country. And we met once or twice a week in different subgroups. And I would hear from a surgeon a particular kind of problem that they had with in ovarian cancer, or a clinician. And I would say, okay, well, I have an idea. If we were going to approach it from an engineering perspective, I would build this kind of test or this particular kind of device. And this is for looking for very tiny lesions on fallopian tubes, for example. Okay. And then the question would come up, well, how do you sample those so that you can get a few cells and sample them in a living tissue? And I'd say, well, I don't know how to do that, but I know someone who I think would be really good at that. And then I would pull in another engineer who could think about that. So, you know, being a part of a community like that, well, we all have the same goal, right? We all have the same goal to cure ovarian cancer, to extend women's lives, to help women get the best possible care. We all have the same goal, but we're all bringing our best tools. We're all bringing our best ideas together. We're brainstorming and being respectful and listening to each other's ideas and where the limitations are and discussing it. And at the end of the day, building a really strong team. So that gives me a tremendous amount of hope.
Why are you working on ovarian cancer particularly? And like, where do things stand in terms of what you're trying to do?
So it's an interesting question, and I can answer it from a couple different directions. Over 10 years ago, I was really happy working on batteries and solar cells and catalysts. And the president of MIT at the time, Susan Hockfield, came to me and said, you know, have you thought about working on cancer? I'm putting together this new institute where it's going to be cancer biologists and engineers working together, you know, in the same building, in the same floors. And I said, well, you know, I work on batteries and I work on solar cells. Right. And at the time, you know, I kind of politely declined. And the reason I did is I thought, well, this is one of the most important problems. And, you know, am I close enough to this problem where I can make a difference? Because I don't want to work on anything, you know, where I can't make a difference. Mm-hmm. And that's one reason. And as I thought about it more deeply, like many people, my family's life has been deeply affected by cancer. And my mom had uterine cancer when I was born. And I was born, and then she went under for a full hysterectomy at 25. And then had reoccurring breast cancer after that, and then died early from breast cancer. And so at the same time, I'm thinking, wow, this is, I really want the best people working on that. So I said, at that time, I said, okay, this seems like a really fantastic opportunity. And we had these, we had like kind of boot camps for cancer for people like me who didn't, you know, I actually have a degree in biology, but, you know, I've never worked on cancer to learn about it. And again, to me, the key is that the team that you put together, and this is true in companies, this is true in your lab, I'm sure it's true in almost any field, it's a team that you put together. But everyone was just so accepting of teaching each other what they needed to go. And so we had these kind of speed dating events where we're meeting.
Really?
With,
a lot of PhD. Everybody has a PhD at the speed dating, right?
Yes, or an MD, or both.
Or an MD. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And so I met Michael Beer, who was at MGH at the time. And he's an oncologist who works on ovarian cancer. And he was convincing me that I should work on ovarian cancer. And what I had brought to my speed date was this technology that we developed based on our solar cell technology, but it was an imaging technology to be able to look deep inside of the body with light.
Okay.
And it was a very, you know, rough prototype that was version one we were on at the time, and now we're on version six in the lab of these instruments that we've built. And he basically, what he told me is he said, well, ovarian cancer is the cancer that you should focus on, and it's because it's diagnosed so late. Mm. And that, you know, 70% of the cases are late stage ovarian cancer, and that 70% of them also relapse after surgery and chemotherapy. And, you know, he said, you can make an impact if you were able to find the tumors. And then so working with him, we developed image-guided surgical tools to still in animals at the time where we could find very small ovarian tumors. We built a system that would help the surgeon find these tiny tumors and then remove them. Because the way ovarian cancer is a lot of people think it's like a single tumor in the abdominal space, but it could be lots of tumors.
Okay.
And they're usually removed surgically and followed up by chemotherapy. And so we set about to help find not just the larger tumors you'd be able to see by eye, but to find tiny tumors that surgeons couldn't see by eye by getting them to light up under certain conditions. And so then we went on and built several different instruments after that for trying to see ovarian tumors earlier. And right now, after all these conversations that I had, you know, with these teams for breakthrough cancer, after all these conversations, we've decided to build an instrument that can scan fallopian tubes to find the very early kind of precancer lesions to ovarian cancer so that they can be studied and better understood. And eventually, we want to take these different technologies we're using to develop a way for early diagnosis.
So it sounds like there's still a long way to go to get to the point where we can diagnose ovarian cancer very early before it's so deadly as it is now.
That's true. But there's not only the technology that we're working on. There's people are working on new kinds of markers for ovarian cancer. My colleague Sangeeta Bhatia works on also blood and urine tests for early diagnostics of ovarian cancer and other kinds of cancers. And so, you know, it's a big concerted effort with many great ideas. But I think what's important is to give people the space and the basic science to do invention and develop new ideas. But then you need at least I need the reality check of interacting with cancer biologists and physicians to see whether what we do makes sense from a diagnostic or imaging or treatment standpoint.
So it sounds like the toolkit is expanding, that when you think about, you know, the tools that existed decades ago to fight cancer, you really have a much wider array now and different kinds of folks contributing like tools and ideas that they've come up with.
I think that's true. And look what's happened with immunotherapy in the last several years, how excitement new treatments are coming around that. And there's a lot of interest in expanding that to other kinds of cancers as well.
Hmm. So obviously, a lot of academics, you're in this category, have created companies that like spin out from their lab. What's your sense right now of that, I don't know, tug or balance between academics and their labs, like our researchers? Is there a lot of directions that researchers are being pulled in? Like, what's your sense of... Obviously, pendulum swing, and so 10 years ago might be different from now, but where do you feel like we are now?
I think that there's, you know, a lot of opportunity in green synthesis and green science, environmentally friendly synthesis of materials that maybe there wasn't in the past as much. I remember when I was first thinking about making biomaterials using real organisms or using proteins from the organisms, the aspect that you could do it at lower temperature and using cleaner solutions and solvents wasn't a big draw, at least in funding. But I think it is now. And there's so much opportunity in terms of people interested in funding, you know, solutions to reduce carbon, for example, or CO2 to products, or cleaner ways of manufacturing important precursor molecules that are used to make and grow all kinds of polymers and other materials.
When you take a little bit more of a 30,000-foot view, I mean, I know you have a good sense of MIT, but you probably also know people at different institutions all over the country who you are in touch with. I wonder, like, do you worry, and maybe this is not a concern, but do you worry that, you know, that great people are leaving academia because there are so many opportunities elsewhere? Or do you think, no, that's like not an issue?
Well, so I'm not sure why I would worry about great people leaving academia, because we need great people everywhere. Mm-hmm. And at MIT, it's very compatible to be both an academic and to start companies and to consulting companies. And so I know other institutions like that as well. And that's why I've always said, you know, this is really the best job in the world, because you get to teach, you get to do research, you get to invent, and all the great things associated with being in academia. And for me and for many of my colleagues, actually translating those inventions either to your own company or another company to see where they can make an impact in the world is just fantastic. And in terms of our students, our graduate students and our undergraduates, I always encourage people to follow what they're most passionate about. You could have a big impact in so many different areas. So find the one that that you're most excited about, and that could be in academia, but it could be, you know, going straight into your own startup company or working in a startup company. So I'm not worried about that.
This is even bigger, but when you think about education, I read a quote of yours somewhere that you said, we're in such a place on the planet where we really need new ideas and new inventions. How are we doing on that front when you think about people who are kind of coming up through the pipeline?
Well, I mean, I think I've said for the last 10 years, there's never been a more important time to be a scientist or engineer. There's so many problems that need to be solved, and there's so many solutions where at least part of the answer is from science, engineering, or invention. So in that case, you know, we need the brightest minds working on that. But, you know, since the pandemic as well, I felt like there's never been more important time to be a biological engineer, which I am. There's never been a more important time where we can have such impact on the planet. And that's not only through, you know, infectious disease and medicine, but it's also through agriculture, energy, and the environment. I think the key is encouraging young people that this is important and this is a great career path. Now, in general, you know, the young people that I work with, our undergraduates at MIT, are so enthusiastic about doing research that makes a difference. And I can really tell you that that's the best part of coming to work every day, is it gives you so much hope to be surrounded by young people that feel so excited and driven to solve some of the most pressing problems on the planet. It gives me an amazing amount of hope.
Is there a biggest hindrance you feel like to commercializing the important research in your field? Like, is there something that you know, see people running into in terms of a barrier?
So, in my own particular area, most of the materials that I end up being interested in commercializing are materials. And in those cases, it's been, and I think this is true in medicine and therapeutics as well, is the amount of funding it takes to get something to your proof of concept, and then pilot, and then to scale. And so you hear about this kind of valley of death where you go from a working prototype, which you can hold in your hand and shows it works, to something that is scaled in an industrial product or process. I don't know the answer for, you know, how to change that. But I think that that's one of the main things that I see right now.
Okay. And so the valley of death is between the having one and having 100,000. Right.
Well, not initially having one, but having several. And, you know, because it's also, it depends on if you're integrating into another product or to another process as well. But, you know, showing something that can work on a smaller scale and then getting it into a worldwide product is definitely a challenge.
Angela Belcher is head of the Department of Biological Engineering at MIT. Angela, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to you for listening.
If you want to hear from another scientist working at the cutting edge, check out our recent episode titled Turning Pollution into Jet Fuel and Yoga Pants, in which we talked to Dr. Jennifer Holmgren, a chemist and the CEO of LanzaTech. And of course, if you want to receive new episodes of the show every week, subscribe. Instigators of Change is produced by Matt Purdy. We'll talk to you next week.